The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, and 24/7 support. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer code Guardian to get 20% off during the month of September.
Hello, and welcome back to Science Weekly with me, Alok Jha. Coming up:
no matter how we let our imagination run wild, whatever we get back is always more exciting and more fantastic than we had thought.
I'm joined by the leading astrophysicist, Athena Koustinis. She's here to talk about her decades-long search for life beyond Earth.
Well, we're talking between 1.75 and 3.25 billion years before the sun is warm enough.
So you're not talking about this weekend.
I didn't say it earlier because I'm a professional and I hold it back.
I'll also be joined by the Guardian science team to discuss a potentially terminal diagnosis for life on Earth. We only have a few billion years left before the sun makes life on Earth unbearable. Also, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change will reveal this week why a few billion years might be wildly optimistic as they release their latest update on the state of climate science, their first since 2007. And we'll trip through why small zebrafish have become such a big player in scientific research. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Let's get going with some news. With me to discuss the goings-on in the world of science this week are Emily Grossman, expert in molecular biology and genetics, who now spends her time telling people about the joys of science. Hello, Emily.
Good morning.
Also here are the Guardian and Observer's Ian Sample and Robin McKee, the Batman and Robin of the science world. How are you both?
Fine. Better
now.
I demand I'm the Batman. I'm not having it.
You want to be Batman?
Yes.
Right, okay.
He's got a cooler car for Christ's sake.
Well, as the Batman of the science establishment here, Robin, let's start with you.
Right.
A very serious story. The IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, is set to reveal its latest report on the state of climate science. It's first since 2007. And this is going to happen this week. Tell us what this report is all about.
Well, what they've got here, this is the physical science basis for climate change. It's going to be debated in this report. A draft version has been published, and scientists are presenting this to government officials in Stockholm as of today. They're presenting this to government officials as of today. And basically, they will hammer out and argue over each paragraph in this very, very long report. They will change the wording a little bit, but essentially, they will come to the conclusion that's in the draft report that the scientists have worked out with far greater precision and more confidence the state of the planet, climate, over the next century. In particular, they will debate the issue of sea level rises, which were not discussed properly in the last draft report, and will conclude that up to a meter's rise in sea level is very, very likely by the end of the century, possibly more. It will dismiss the idea that there is any prospect that geoengineering will be able to offset any of these changes in a meaningful manner. It will discuss briefly the issue of coral reef damage, because acidification of the ocean, regardless of the rising temperatures above it in the atmosphere, the acidification of oceans will virtually destroy our coral reefs by the end of the century. There is now unambiguous, they don't actually use the word unambiguous, but it's very certain that temperature rises have increased by 0.89% degrees centigrade since 1901, and that's almost entirely due to man-made activity. So in other words, this is the most emphatic statement that we have had to date about the impact that our industrial activities are having on the climate of this planet.
Let's get something straight here. We know climate change is happening. That's a certainty.
Not if you do the Daily Mail.
Let's stay serious for a moment. We know it's happening. And in 2007, when the previous version of this report came out, it was still certain then. So it's not like we've now discovered that this is more certain than ever. This is about detail and about locality of predictions, isn't it? And the precision of the predictions, because the climate models have become better. Our ability to forecast has become better. Computers have become better, basically.
Yes.
I mean, it's interesting what you say about their predictions. I mean, this report is going to be published in several stages. The first bit is the sort of hard science. Then there's going to be policy recommendations, not policy recommendations, but summaries for policymakers. And then, of course, in the next COP meetings and so on, people will take this into account. It doesn't mean that any government will do anything differently, does it?
No, that has to come next. That comes essentially in 2015. That's when the next big climate meeting is. And the report says that if we burn 1 trillion tonnes of carbon equivalent in fossil fuels, there is a very strong likelihood that we will have raised the global temperature by 2 degrees centigrade. That is the upper limit of what is acceptable.
By the end of the century?
No, if we do that.
If we do that at any point.
If we do that. And what it's saying is that we've burned half of that to date, and the other half trillion, if we burn that over the next few decades, as it looks like we are going to do, we will have reached our 2 degree centigrade limit. And so it's saying, at the present rate, this is your upper limit, lads. This is, I know you've got another 500 billion tons of carbon equivalent. If you burn it, then we're in serious trouble. So what are you going to do, governments of the world, to stop that happening?
There was discussions a few years ago around, I remember, the climate change conferences in Copenhagen and stuff, that 2 degrees C rise, temperature rise, by the end of this century was the catastrophic sort of scenario. Yeah. And that we should try our best not to do that. And people were talking about how to make sure we don't do that. Now, the rhetoric is all about the fact that 2 degrees C is almost inevitable. By the end of the century, we've given up on that, and let's not have catastrophic climate change. Let's start adapting. Did you see this? These warnings getting even more severe. Essentially,
you're quite right. There's a displacement going on. One hand, everybody seems to have got used to the idea, and there's a recent BBC survey showed that the number of British people who were describe themselves as climate sceptics has risen from 15% to 19%. And equally, there are people
who
just
say... What
does
it even mean to be a climate sceptic now, though?
I don't know. An IQ of under room temperature, I would have thought. But I don't know. But it's quite clearly people are turned off by it. And at the same time, we're getting even starker warnings from the scientists.
Emily, give us your thoughts
on this.
Well,
I think what's really terrifying is that there's still so many people who are opposed to the idea of climate change and who are really sceptical and are shouting very loudly about the fact that it's not true and are actually campaigning and approaching the relevant scientific bodies and saying, actually, your research is flawed and it's not actually happening. And there may not be many of those people, but there's, like I said, they're shouting very loudly and their voices are getting heard. And a lot of people are saying, well, if there's flaws in the science, if there's flaws in the logic of the research, then, oh, maybe we shouldn't believe it. So,
I mean, this report, just this one aspect of the IPCC's overall report, is written by 250 scientists. It's a very conservative document. It's not alarmist. It's not written by the kind of what you might call, the alarmists.
Well, exactly.
It's very sober analysis of what's going on, and yet still people won't accept it.
Robin, final word to you on this before we move on. In the many, many years that this has become a huge issue, it's been a huge issue for a long time, but it's getting more and more political and media attention and stuff. Scientists have, as we said, been quite conservative about what they predict. They don't want to say this is caused by climate change or that this is caused by climate change or what the exact numbers are. As they see that no one's really doing very much about it in the world, do you see scientists getting more and more sort of out there saying, look, we've got to do something about this? Or are they still quite restrained?
I surprisingly restrained is why I would put it. They're still not... there are a few that scream from the rooftops, but by and large, I think they still think there's a danger in that by saying the Arctic summer sea ice will have gone within 5 years, and it isn't gone within 5 years, and then the sceptics turn around and go, oh, look at that, typical alarmist behaviour. So I think quiet sobriety, but insistent sobriety, as it were, is probably still the best approach.
It's always been worrying.
I don't know how they put up with it sometimes.
Worrying sometimes, isn't it? To just say, I told you so all the time, isn't it?
Yes.
Emily.
The inherent problem is that it's not in scientists' nature to be sensationalist about information.
Not my job.
Whereas the sceptics are. So they'll pick up on one tiny little gap in that causal link that we're talking about, and they'll say, oh, well, it might cause it. So obviously the scientists don't really know. They don't know what they're talking about. When in fact it probably does. But scientists aren't going to stick their heads up there and say, yes, it does definitely, because that's not what a scientist does.
Yeah, the arguments on the both sides of this argument, if in inverted commas, they're operating on slightly different rules, aren't they? One's a scientific rules, which is all about sort of being slightly dispassionate about things, evidence and all those things. And the other's quite emotional. And these are all valid ways of arguing, but they're not the same thing anyway. Emily, let's talk about something very positive about has been happening in the world of science in the last a few years, really. Tell us about zebrafish, and what's a zebrafish ever done for me?
Well, I really loved this story, Robin's story this week about the zebrafish, because they're these 2-inch little fishies that are found in freshwater in Asia, and they're stripy. And you've probably come across them if you've ever been to the Far East. But they're absolutely amazing because they've been proved to be indispensable in medical research. And that's for two reasons. So they're a perfect model system for studying human diseases. And also they're shedding light on the functions of all 20,000 of our genes. And there's two main reasons for this. Firstly is that they have an amazing similarity in their genetic structure to our genes. So about 70% of our genes have equivalent genes in zebrafish. In fact, of our genes that cause diseases, about 84% of these have equivalents in zebrafish. And the other thing that's amazing about the zebrafish in terms of studying them is that their embryos are transparent. And that, coupled with the fact that they grow really super fast, means that you can actually mutate some of the genes and watch what happens to the embryos without having to kill them. And what's great about that is that you can link a defect in the behaviour or in the appearance of a zebrafish. So, for example, if it lacks pigmentation, you can link that to the gene that caused it. And they have actually found for a lot of these genes that the equivalent in humans does the same thing. So the equivalent gene in humans causes defects in pigmentation in human skin. And that's really, really important because thanks to the Human Genome Project, we know the sequence of the 20,000 of our human genes. But what we don't know for the vast majority is what they actually do. So this study is a brilliant way of finding out what these genes do.
So this is all very good, but we already have mice who do all of these things. And there's a whole industry around animal research using mice. And they're closer to us since they're mammals in terms of genetics. So what's the zebrafish got that a mouse doesn't? If are you putting mice out of business here?
No, they've got transparency, that's what.
Yes, yeah, so you can actually study what you can watch it without killing them as well, which is a really big thing. And the model is not just to figure out what the genes do, but they're also a really perfect system for studying what goes wrong and what can cause diseases. So, for example, they found that if they mutate one type of gene, the little zebrafish embryos grow bent, and that actually mimics what is seen in a form of muscular dystrophy in children. So by looking at that gene, you can find the equivalent gene in humans and say, that's the gene that's mutated in muscular dystrophy. And not only that, but then you can search for drugs which help the zebrafish to then go back to their normal growth. And those drugs should and hopefully will have the equivalent effect on children suffering from these diseases.
So the model is obviously a good one, and as you described all the advantages. But what limitations should we be careful of? Because fish are quite evolutionarily far away from us. It might be that the genes do have analogues in humans, but we're way more complicated, and the expression of those genes is going to be different. But how excited should we be about the potential of the research coming out of zebrafish labs?
Well, I think what's beautiful about DNA is that if the gene is an analogue, then if it's an equivalent gene, then if you're adding a drug that actually helps the defects of that gene, then it should do the same in humans if the gene is the equivalent. And what you can do is you can test hundreds and hundreds of drugs very quickly on the zebrafish and work out which of those have an effect. So which of those would help, for example, zebrafish that can't develop their heart properly. There's studies going on in Sheffield to add drugs back that will help them to grow and their hearts to grow. And the point is, if you find one that works for zebrafish, then you move to clinical trials. Then you start to look for whether it works in humans. But you've got a brilliant starting point.
I'll tell you what I love about zebrafish. I mean, not literally love, that'd be weird. But what I like about zebrafish, if you take a zebrafish that's just been born and you chop its heart in half, sounds like a cruel thing to do, but this has been done, then it regenerates within a few days. The whole heart will regenerate, and the zebrafish are very good at this, and they're being studied by people at places like Oxford and various other places to look at what markers and particular chemical factors are in those cells that allow these amazing regenerations to happen. If you do it after 7 days old, then the heart doesn't regenerate properly. But within those first 7 days, something strange is going on that allows that to happen. Robin, you wrote this epic love story to zebrafish for the Observer's Tech Monthly magazine, which is just launched. What did you think about these plucky little things?
I'm glad you mentioned the Tech Monthly, because I just want to plug that there. It's coming out in every month in the new.
What's that?
Monthly, science, ideas, you name it, it's got it. 44 pages of precision and the best science writing, including writers like Ian Sample and Alec Jah. You know, the very, very
top. I wouldn't read those people. But tell us about zebrafish.
Sorry. They're lovely. I agree. They're great little things. And they've got tanks and tanks. They've got about 65,000 of them at the Sanger Centre in little kind of little tanks. And all you need is a little net, and you can take one home.
The Sanger Centre
in a plastic bag. I made that last bit up.
The Sanger Centre. This is the place in just outside Cambridge.
That's the genome campus where they did a lot of the work on decoding the human genome. And now, as you say, they are finding out having found out the structure of those genes. They're now using zebrafish to find out what actually the genes do, and they'll go a long way down the road to getting it. You're quite right. They're not the absolute total answer, but my God, they've proven pretty useful so far.
And they've just received funding, haven't they, to actually look at the mutations in 8,000 sets of zebrafish. And they're saying that hopefully by the end of this research, they should be able to pinpoint the function as something like 80 to 90% of all human genes just by looking at these sets of zebrafish. And that's going on at the Sanger Institute.
Ian, this is an amazing story you're going to tell us now about how the sun is going to wipe out all life on Earth. I mean, we kind of know that that's going to happen. The sun's going to expand and explode at one point in a few billion years. But so this is something different about how the sun's evolution will mean that life on Earth is going to get difficult.
Yeah, there are a million routes to doom, and you've written about quite
a lot. I've written about
them.
A few of them, yeah.
And we all enjoy this existential stuff, you know. But this was a nice study, to me at least, which was looking at, you're probably familiar with habitable zones. These are the sort of stretches of space around a star where the sort of, you call them Goldilocks zones as well, where the sort of the temperature on the surface of a planet there is not too hot or too cold for liquid water to exist. And the relevance of that is seen as if we're sort of basing our ideas of life on life on Earth, then you'd say, well, you need flowing water, available water for life to take hold. So it's an interesting idea. You look for planets in habitable zones when you're looking at exoplanets, so those outside our solar system, stuff like that. But the interesting thing is that these habitable zones aren't static. I mean, the habitable zone itself is a fairly rough measure, but they're not stationary in space, because stars go through this evolutionary cycle of evolutionary lifetime. And as stars get older, they burn brighter, they burn hotter. So a habitable zone actually moves out away from a star. So what these guys at University of East Anglia did is they looked at how long a planet would stay in its habitable zone. So they came up with habitable zone lifetimes for a whole bunch of planets, including our own. And what they found was that at the moment, the Earth is probably about 70% way through its habitable zone lifetime. And that means that it will fall out of the habitable zone. It will no longer be essentially habitable within a certain period. And we've got a fair bit of time on our hands. It's not for...
How long are we talking?
Well, we're talking between 1.75 and 3.25 billion years before...
Okay,
the sun is warm enough.
So you're not talking about this weekend.
I didn't say it early because I'm a professional and I hold it back. And the idea is that by then the sun will be so hot that it will be too toasty on Earth for liquid water to hang around, and the habitable zone would have moved out towards Mars and stuff like that.
So are we going to move to Mars then? Is that the idea? Is that what?
Well, the researcher reckoned that was a pretty good plan, although Mars doesn't have an atmosphere, so you'd have to kind of construct that. But you've got a bit of time on your hands.
You've got a billion years.
You've got a billion years.
Or to build spaceships.
And he also admitted that we probably wouldn't look like humans really anymore by then anyway. So whatever is around like? May want to go somewhere else is about as specific as we can be.
Emily, as our local on-tap biologist here, what are humans going to look like in a billion years? Come on, give us an answer.
By the sound of the climate change issues, we're not going to be here. That's the thing.
This is true.
What I found really interesting, though, in that article is that the scientists had found other planets that had habitable zones that had been around for approximately the same amount of time, not as the origin of the Earth, but since it's become habitable, and that is the potential for looking for other forms of life that could be equivalent to humans, because, of course, if something's been around for the same amount of time, it's possible that evolution probably didn't take the same path, but it's got enough time to get somewhere along the road to looking something like what we've got here on Earth today. And that's a good place to then start looking for other forms of potential life in other galaxies.
Well, let's pause the discussion there, because our interview coming after this is much more about exoplanets and habitable zones and all sorts of things. So there'll be loads more on that. And in fact, about where the habitable zones are as we've just defined them, in fact. Thanks to Emily, Ian and Robin for all those stories and more. You can go to the best science news site on the web, it says here, theguardian.com/science and theguardian.com/tech. What will alien life forms look like? Where will they be found? And more crucially, when? Now, these are some of the most tantalising questions to both scientists and non-scientists. As you just heard in our news discussion, they feed our common imagination about what might be out there. If anyone can give us a well-informed answer, it's Athena Koustinis. She's a leading astrophysicist and director of research at the National Centre for Scientific Research in France. She's spent a career studying the various planets and moons of our solar system, in particular Titan, one of the largest satellites of Saturn. With her colleague Thérèse Encrenaz, she's written a new book titled Life Beyond Earth, The Search for Habitable Worlds in the Universe. She came into the studio to tell me about some of those biggest of questions about the possibility of life among the stars. Athena, thank you very much for coming to the podcast. We're here to talk about exoplanets, the sort of life, search for life beyond Earth. But before we talk about the cutting edge, let's talk about what we knew about this area of research more than a decade ago. More than a decade ago, it was felt like there was maybe a few exoplanets, planets outside our solar system. There wasn't much more optimism than that, apart from Carl Sagan saying a few sort of romantic things about life out there. Paint us a picture of your area of work about 10 years ago.
I'll even go a little bit further back. In 1995, we were in Capri with Michel Mayor. Michel Mayor is the first discoverer of an exoplanet, 51 Pegasi. And we were sitting there having a nice dinner, and he was telling me how he was going to publish this paper on the first detection of an exoplanet. I said, oh, that's fantastic. And he says, well, yeah, but nobody believes me. This is a taboo subject. We couldn't even go to a telescope and say we're going to look for exoplanets because nobody wanted to give us time at that. And I told Michel, I said, go for it. You know, and he published his paper, and others contested it for a little while. And then the Americans came on board and said, yes, this is an exoplanet. That was 20 years ago almost. Today, we've got thousands on the table. The confirmed ones are in the hundreds and thousands more for us candidates. Nobody considers these a taboo subject. Same for astrobiology. This is a field I'm working in, which is the search for life beyond Earth. A little while ago, 10 years ago, nobody wanted to talk about it. You were really a strange person. You're not a real scientist if you're talking about astrobiology. And today, several of us claim that we are astrobiologists because we're not looking necessarily for life. We're looking for conditions in which life could emerge or be sustained in a place. That's what we call the habitats.
So we'll talk about the idea of looking for life in just a second, but tell us how we look for exoplanets now. What is the technology, what is the sort of techniques that have been developed in recent years that have really pushed up the number we have?
Oh, God, we've gone such a long way. We've evolved so much. We started by having very indirect methods in looking for exoplanets. For instance, looking for little perturbations in the system of the star and the planet itself. This little wobbling thing that would tell us that there was something revolving around the star. Today, we can image exoplanets. It's fantastic. We started out with huge planets. We're only looking for giant planets like the ones we have in our own solar system. Now we're down to Earth-sized planets and we're looking at images of them. We can separate them from the star. It's not just artists anymore that can send pictures of exoplanets.
You're not talking about optical images here, though, are you?
No, I'm not talking about optical. It's infrared, mostly, and it's also a lot of adaptive optics and things like that we have today in hand. But, I mean, we've gone really a long way into having different means of determining not only seeing the exoplanet, but also determining characteristics of the exoplanet. For instance, spectroscopy. Spectroscopy is something we use today from ground-based telescopes and also from space to look at exoplanets. What do we do with spectroscopy? We can tell you what's in their atmospheres. For instance, water, methane, oxygen. What do we find? So it's much more than just having candidates or looking at them or defining how many there can be around a star. It's more about learning whether they look or not like the planets we have in our own solar system.
So, as I said, a few years, we've gone from one or two or a dozen exoplanets found through painstaking searches of star catalogues and maps to essentially a factory. Things like NASA's Kepler probe and others thousands. Have found thousands of candidates. And so you find a candidate because of maybe in Kepler's case, it transits in front of the star and the light dims or other wobbles and things. And these are sort of essentially you've got a massive data and you have to chuck out all the noise and then you're left with a candidate, and then you train other telescopes onto that area to confirm. And as you say, we're getting more and more information about what makes up those planets. What's coming in the next couple of decades? I mean, that's happened in 10 years, all the things I've described. We've got to thousands. We're going to get to millions. What's coming in the next few decades? Will we be able to take an optical picture of an exoplanet anytime soon?
The new telescopes that are coming on board are large. They're huge, like the SKA, the kilometer array, square kilometer array, or ARMA. All of these telescopes are getting bigger and bigger, and they have higher resolution as time comes on. It's not only a matter of are we going to be able to see them optically, it's also a matter of how big or how small, rather, they can be, and we can still detect them. So there are two aspects. One of them is detecting the exoplanets, like you just said. We've gone up to thousands, we're going to go up to millions pretty soon. And the other thing is to characterize them. I think one of the major lessons we got out of the exoplanet search is that the giant planet that Michel Mayor found first was so close to its star, whereas in our solar system, the giant planets are sitting in the outer edges, right? So first thing that hit us is, oh, all planetary systems are not the same. We've got giant planets there. That put forward the theory of migration in our solar system. We know now that giant planets may migrate closer to the stars or go back. They can move. They're not just fixed in space. The second thing we learn is that they may very well have completely different atmospheres, completely different surfaces. We have to go by an archetype, of course, every time. But we've opened up a whole new search field in astronomy. It's completely different, and I think the most amazing thing is that it teaches us to keep a broad mind.
Well, so this is interesting because one of the there are many questions in astronomy. One of which is, how do planetary systems form? How does our planetary system form? There are many sort of hypotheses about how the Earth and the other planets came together. And I suppose by seeing other planetary systems, you see these things in different stages of evolution and you learn more about that. So that's where we're really going to, isn't it? It's nice to image planets and talk about them in newspapers. I mean, but beyond that, what we've ended up doing is listing them. It's like genetics. It used to be every gene we found was exciting, and now there's so many that they're just not anymore. So, you know, now we've got to the stage where finding an exoplanet's like, oh, no, not another exoplanet. But what's this catalogue telling you about, you know, how stars and planetary systems form?
Exactly. And they're telling us that, first of all, they may not all form in the same way, but also that our own solar system may not have formed exactly the way we think it had, with the planets exactly in the location they are. And all of a sudden, we're getting so many new theories and so many new insights. For instance, why Mars is where it is? Why is it so small? Could Jupiter have perturbed its orbit at an earlier stage when it was in it. Why is Neptune and Uranus, the icy giants, so different from Jupiter and Saturn? These are questions we've been asking ourselves in astronomy for ages now. And seeing the exoplanets, seeing the exoplanetary systems being so different is bringing us new answers, actually, new theories.
And so what about this search for life, then? That's what everyone will probably ask you if you sort of tell them you're searching for planets elsewhere. There's no hints of it so far, but how easy would it be to detect the signs of life on something many light years away?
It's actually not so difficult. The first thing we could go by, for instance, is a spectroscopic search for something like signatures by ozone, chlorophyll, things like that that we see when we look at our own planet.
This is gases in the atmosphere.
That's right. That's gases in the atmosphere. It's the signatures of the of life existing on our own planet, on the surface, and in the atmosphere. So when we look at the Earth from far away, we see the signatures in the spectrum. Same for Venus, you know, there's not life there, but we see specific signatures in each planet's atmosphere. When we do spectroscopy of an exoplanet, which we do today, we're able of making this kind of measurements, we can look for specific signatures for this kind of gases, this kind of, for instance, chlorophyll is something, you know, that comes from plants. And then if we see this kind of thing, then we know, all right, this planet has got ozone, this planet has got this kind of transformation, this kind of chemical reaction. Maybe that could come from this, or definitely this comes from
So you're looking for these signs of these molecules. And what's the closest we've come to finding any of that sort of stuff out there?
Well, same as when we look at objects in our own solar system. For instance, when we detect organic chemistry, we get very excited because organic chemistry is, of course, the basis for life on our own planet. But in our own solar system, we can send a space mission then and do in situ measurements and define whether life is there or not. We have found molecules like methane, some hydrocarbons and things like that on exoplanets. That doesn't necessarily mean there's life, but it means that you can have this kind of precursors for life on other exoplanets.
Is there a smoking gun? The hydrocarbons and things like methane and stuff, you find them on planets in the solar system as well, and we know there's no life there. Well, we think not anyway. What's the smoking gun? What is the thing you find, you think, right, this is like, unless we can visit, we're not going to find out, we're not going to disprove this.
Well, as we explain in our research for life beyond Earth, there are four conditions that we think you have to, four requirements that you need. If you're to consider a place, first of all, a habitat. Before you look for life, you have to see if the conditions are there. And we're talking about life as we know it on Earth, all right? I'm not talking about different forms of life. I'm not a biologist. So for life on Earth, you need liquid water. You need organic chemistry or nutrients to support this kind of life. You need energy sources, some kind of heating to get all of this system working and sustained. And you need it to be a stable environment. You cannot have a planet that is not in a stable situation affording the development of life for a long period of time. So the first thing we do is to look for this for requirements. So if we see organic chemistry in the atmosphere, then we have to have find a way of looking for liquid water. And there were proposals for detections of water in some planets in the atmosphere. Again, that doesn't necessarily mean that there's liquid water.
Water is very common in the universe.
It's very common in the universe. But, okay, there's a smoking gun again, but then you need to see if that planet could have sources of energy inside, from the interior, or from the environment, and so on. And then you have to monitor it long enough to see if it's a stable environment. Now, if we have these four conditions, then it becomes a smoking gun. And we're thinking, okay, this is a habitat far, far away from here. Maybe life could have developed there. And then we need to go back and observe again and again and look with larger telescopes.
And scientists talk about something called the habitable zone around a star.
Right.
So this is the distance from a star where, well, for example, water is not a completely vapor or completely ice.
Exactly.
You need liquid water rather than
just
water itself. And we're getting better at imaging those sorts of things. and you know, that this is all, as you say, the technology gets better and better. I've heard projections that if there is life, or if there is some sort of microbial life even somewhere out there, that we might detect it within a certain period of time, a few decades, given that the rate of increase of technology. Is that something that's going to be possible, or is it just romantic dreaming from people?
No, let me throw something back at you. The habitable zone, we thought, until a few years back, was something that was limited to liquid water on the surfaces. Today, I'm collaborating on a space mission called JUICE that is going to go to the Jupiter system, flying in 2022 and arrive on 2030. And it's going to look at some of the moons of Jupiter. And we're not going to be looking for anything on the surface. We're going to be looking under the surface. The habitable zone today in our own solar system has evolved immensely. We're now beyond 10 astronomical units because we understand that there could be liquid water underneath the surface of a planet or a satellite. And we're so excited because the subsurface liquid water oceans would actually be very very good habitats for life.
But you've neatly brought us back to our own solar system, which is a very exciting place also for a lot of this research. And you mentioned JUICE. So JUICE is going to Jupiter, and you're looking at the moons of Jupiter, including, I'm assuming Europa, for example, which is covered in ice. Take us through the best candidates for places where there might be interesting liquid water or seas or some sort of life form.
Oh, and our view of that has evolved immensely also in the past years. And
Arthur C. Clarke had you all predicted beforehand.
Oh my God, Arthur C. Clarke and Carl Sagan had predicted everything.
All of this, yeah.
It's amazing. So JUICE is now selected. We're talking about Istramus at this stage. We're going to go to the Jupiter system and look at Ganymede. Ganymede is the largest satellite in our solar system, and it's the third only object and the only satellite to have a magnetic field. And I didn't say it before, but the reason life has been sustained on Earth is because we're also protected by our magnetic field, and it's only the Earth, Mercury, and Ganymede that have this magnetic field.
Which deflects particles, charged particles, etc., from the sun and so on.
Exactly, and prevents us from being destroyed by solar radiation. So Ganymede is a large satellite, and we think it has a liquid subsurface ocean sandwiched between two ice layers. On Europa, we think this subsurface ocean also exists, but in this case, the ice layer on top is probably thinner than on Ganymede, and the bottom of the liquid ocean is in contact with the silicate floor, which really makes a huge difference in producing an environment favorable for life, as we have on Earth, for instance, the hydrothermal vents, black smokers. So this mission is going to go and look at Ganymede, fly by Europa a couple of times to determine the best regions, best areas above which we can expect to have the thinner ice layer, and then we can penetrate probably with a radar and see if we can detect directly the subsurface ocean and how thick it is, how thick is the ice layer, its properties, and so on.
And so these things are also show the sophistication of probes we're building these days. And I mean, the lander on Titan a few years ago was incredible in terms of showing us for the first time what's you know, on the surface of a satellite of Saturn there, and showed us about these lakes and all things of methane. Fantastic. Yeah. And Cassini, which has obviously been sending back beautiful pictures for so long. And it's funny when you think about it that these things are going to get better and better. Maybe we'll have robots that we can control from here. Am I talking silly things now?
No.
We're going to have robots to control to there.
I hope not. Robotic exploration is always an excellent first step to do. Look what we're doing on Mars. We send robots first, and then maybe one day we'll be able to land somebody there. But the robotic exploration is something we cannot do without. The Huygens probe was a fantastic experience. We've landed.
This is the lander on
Titan. On Titan, and we've landed in a place that's 10 times further from the sun than our own planet. It got there. It landed on the surface. It survived. It returned data for as long as its batteries could afford to do it, 3.5 hours. And we've seen lakes. It's the only other place in the solar system where we have liquid extents exposed. It's hydrocarbons, not water. But still, it's an amazing world. And the Cassini mission is still ongoing until 2017. Everything has worked fantastically well. And we're discovering new worlds, like Enceladus I mentioned before, with the geysers of water vapor.
Where's the energy for those geysers coming from?
Exactly. That's the right question.
Genuinely a question? I just wondered.
That's what we're working on right now.
Oh, okay.
Finding this moon is tiny. It's only 500 kilometers in diameter. Where does it find the energy to have this geysers?
What are your hypotheses for that?
The hypotheses are tidal forces and getting all this through thin crust of ice and through cracks, and then you've got this immense geysers that go out to 400 kilometers in space. A few years back, we thought all of these places were dead. We thought all of these moons were just icy, you know, inactive worlds. And now we see all this energy, all this activity there.
So with Ganymede, with all these other things, you mentioned all these possibilities of places that where at least some sort of lifelike thing might happen. In your community, you've just come from a conference of planetary scientists. Are you just focused on getting these missions out there and coming back with data and then you analyze it? Or do you really harbor secret hopes that there must be something there? What do you discuss over wine?
You know, one thing we can say in our business, at least, is that no matter how wild ideas we get, no matter how we let our imagination run wild, whatever we get back is always more exciting and more fantastic than we had thought. When we landed on Titan, and I had worked on the Cassini-Huygens mission for such a long time, when we landed on Titan, I saw the first images coming in. I was in Darmstadt, the control center of the European Space Agency. I saw this riverbed with the pebbles, water pebbles on it, and I said, oh, where did that come from? Take this Mars picture away or something. And we're waiting for Titan. I said, this is Titan.
Oh, right, and you didn't recognize it.
Nobody, it was familiar for Mars, but we had no expectation. We didn't know what to expect for Titan. We didn't know we'd see channels were Mars, you know, but we saw channels, dunes, we saw lakes, no one could have imagined those things. I mean, we talked about craters and things like that. So it hits us back always as something much more wild than anything we can imagine. So we're being paid to do a job where we can let our imagination run wild.
Let your imagination run wild. What do you hope you'll find when you examine that bit of lake? Say that you've done the juice mission, you've worked out where the ice is thinnest, you've done the radar and all these sorts of things, and then you land and you float down to the bottom of this ocean, and you're at the silicate layer. And what are you hoping to find?
Well, we're all hoping that we will find some information that would help us understand how life came to be on Earth. Even if we don't find life itself, we're missing so many links that take us from biology to real life. So many links, I'm sorry. I mean, when somebody tells me, yes, we know how to make life, I don't think we know. If we find we find elements of how life can emerge and how it can be sustained every day by exploring the solar system, not just our planet. So, for instance, on Titan, we see this organic chemistry we didn't expect, and it's gone far enough. You know, the molecules in the atmosphere are complex enough that now I'm thinking, if we go in a lake, and if I find indication that there is an undersurface liquid wash ocean, because it's also expected on Titan. How do we see that? Well, maybe we'll see some of the water come up, or the ammonia. If we have a cryovolcanic activity, which is also hypothesized on Titan, then we've got the energy. You bring all of this together, and then you think, I've got a habitat. So then you can let your imagination run wild. You can go to the bottom of that ocean, or the Europas Ocean, or Ganymede's Ocean, and why not find some sort of microorganisms living there? And then you think, okay.
And they might be very different from us.
These ones, the ones I'm talking about, should not be different, because I'm going by the requirements for Earth life. If they are very different, then the question is, would we recognize them?
Yeah.
And planetary protection, I have to mention, planetary protection is a very serious matter with us. We wouldn't go to a place damaging or endangering the life that would exist there by bringing the stuff from the Earth. So we're very, very careful about that.
Athena, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much for that.
My pleasure.
Life Beyond Earth, The Search for Habitable Worlds in the Universe, is published by Cambridge University Press and available from October 2013. We'll have a link to the book on our blog. That's all we have for you this week. Many thanks for listening. From me, Alok Jha, and Science Weekly producer Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag-and-drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today, no credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you will get 20% off in September by going to squarespace.com and using the offer code Guardian.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.